With today's program, I celebrate 17 years here on 88.7 FM WICR in Indianapolis. My first show aired April 2nd, 2002, and my first guest was John Robbins, talking about the food revolution, I believe. And over the past 17 years, I've done close to 800 interviews. Now that is hard to believe. So, how am I celebrating this? Well, by playing another interview, of course. When going through the archives, I found a show I did in 2014 with the great Mark Beckoff regarding his book Rewilding Our Hearts. What he shared then is probably even more timely now for our world. Back in the day, the program was called Journey's Fire, and now, of course, it's renamed Dying to Live. But here, in its entirety, as a celebration of 17 years, is my conversation with Mark. On this edition, we're rewilding our hearts with the help of author Mark Beckoff. I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. Each week on Journey's Fire with Richard Brendan, we feature engaging conversations with today's leading visionaries and social change artists, all powerful voices inspiring love in action for ourselves, one another, and the earth. My guest today is Mark Beckoff, who's Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's worked alongside leading writers and activists, including Jane Goodall, Peter Singer, and PETA co-founder Ingrid Newkirk. Mark's new book is Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence. In wildlife conservation work, rewilding refers to habitat restoration and the creation of corridors between preserved lands to allow declining populations to rebound. Mark Beckoff, one of the world's most engaging animal experts and activists, here applies rewilding to human attitudes. He argues that unless we rewild ourselves, becoming profoundly reconnected to nature and fundamentally shifting our consciousness, our conservation efforts will have been but limited impact. Beckoff says, "As I consider a more global and holistic perspective, I go beyond my specific areas of expertise in ethology and compassionate conservation to consider biology, psychology, sociology, philosophy, and anthropology. All of these, in fact, inform studies of animal behavior, animal minds, and conservation biology, but they're not always acknowledged. I also speak as an activist arguing for social change. Ultimately, what we need is not more information about animals, but a social movement and revolution in how we interact with animals and nature." I, for one, have been inspired by this book, and it's a joy and an honor to have him on today's broadcast. And Mark joins us from beautiful Boulder, Colorado. Mark Beckoff, welcome to Journey's Fire.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thank you for your interest in my work.
Well, I have so been interested in your work over the years, and I have loved this new book, Rewilding Our Hearts. Early in the introduction, you write something. I want to quote you. You say, "Nevertheless, we live in a troubled and wounded world that is in dire need of healing. We humans, big-brained, big-footed, overproductive, over-consuming, and invasive mammals, have for a long time acted as if we were the only animals who matter. We have made huge and horrible global messes impacting every environmental and ecosystem and all other species, and these effects need to be halted and, if possible, repaired." And then you say, "This is the issue I want to address in Rewilding Our Hearts."
A small one, of course.
Of course. Share your passion, because your passion is throughout this book in the words that you've used.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, you know, what motivates me and a lot of people to make the world a better place for human animals, non-human animals, and all their habitats, you know, is basically the fact of, you know, the bad things we do. Mm-hmm. But we also do very good things. And I always like to stress that early on. But, you know, we're mammals, and we are, you know, that the only mammal or animal who overproduces, makes too many of us, and overconsumes, and, you know, intrudes wherever we want to go. And that is a major problem. A lot of people define, you know, this period, this geological epoch, as the Anthropocene, you know, the time when we are, as anthropoid apes, having a devastating effect on the world. So that's what kind of, I mean, in a sense, that's what motivates me. And the other thing that motivates me is the fact that we are basically unwilded from the time we're born. And so I look at rewilding as undoing the unwilding.
Yeah, and for our listeners, we addressed this early in the setup for this interview, but in your own words, explain again rewilding our hearts.
Yeah, what I basically mean by rewilding our hearts is reconnecting us to nature and basically becoming re-enchanted with nature. The term rewilding was originally used in conservation biology to refer to projects that were building corridors, like one of the famous ones is the Y-to-Y rewilding project, the Yukon to the Yucatan, where there would be overpasses and underpasses, you know, and basically areas where non-human animals could meander about and travel free of human intervention. And the key word in those sorts of rewilding projects is corridors, building corridors where animals are free to move. And what came to me was the fact that we could also have corridors in our bodies, literally, that would begin with our feelings in our heart, and that would then turn into action. You know, we'd feel something, we'd think about it, and we'd do something, you know, hopefully positive for the earth at large. And that's where it came from. So the subtitle of my book is Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence. And that's what it really refers to, is these pathways in our body. We feel something, we feel really strongly for something, and then we basically act on it. So rewilding is basically acting from the inside out.
And so you ask a question early on in the book, who could be against a global social movement based on peace, compassion, empathy, and love? And I'm thinking, yeah, right. Who could be against that? And yet we know there are many who have ulterior motives and are against that. And I'm wondering, in the decades that you have devoted your life to this cause, to see a global social movement take off, today, are you more encouraged than before, or are you a bit discouraged?
I'm more encouraged. I'm sort of a hardcore, you know, genetic optimist. but I am more encouraged just because I travel and I meet a lot of people. And when I talk to them about this idea of rewilding, I try to make it clear to them that, you know, they don't have to be wealthy and make millions of dollars of contributions to any organization. They don't have to found an organization. That every little bit that an individual can do really helps the world at large. And you're right. I mean, when you say to people, well, how could you be against a world where there's more compassion and peace and peaceful coexistence? I think one of the problems is that people define it differently, and that's okay. I mean, you know, we're all different personalities and we all have very different views of the world. So the real challenge is how some people believe that it is, that it's, that, you know, sacrificing animals, for example, for the good of humans, and doing it in a humane, compassionate way is a compassionate move. And, you know, while I may disagree, there's going to be trade-offs in the real world, and we're going to have to work with one another. And I may disagree with something that you feel or something that you do, but I really need to understand, you know, unless it's somebody who's just malicious, I really need to understand why they're taking a particular point of view. And so, you know, that's the challenge. But I am, I'm optimistic. Later on today, I'm going to talk to a I guess a girl who's a senior in high school, and she's very interested in the relationship between animal cognition, animal emotions, and how we protect them, which is something, you know, I've been working on for a really long time. So I did a kids event recently, and, you know, these six-year-olds are asking me questions, some of which I never even thought about even now.
Wow. And that's what's so exciting, is to see high schoolers, to see even six-year-olds really start asking those questions and have a heart where they care about the earth and they care about our animal companions.
Exactly. And, you know, I talk about rewilding education. And what I really mean by that is weaving in humane education, conservation education into, you know, formally into school programs.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting kids outside, letting them just go outside and play spontaneously. I always say, let them be the animals who they are.
Yeah. Yeah, I recently had animal advocate Linda Bender on the program, and she said something I found interesting. She said, as we treat our animals, we treat ourselves.
Right. The bottom line for rewilding, or maybe it's not the bottom line, but an important bottom line, is that by rewilding and reconnecting with other nature, we are also helping ourselves. And so, you know, the way I look at it, it's a big, vast world, and if somebody goes out and does something good for other animals, including humans, and our homes, and they're motivated because it makes them feel good, mm-hmm. that's okay, because the end result is they're doing something good. And so, you know, some people go, well, you know, they're really being selfish, they're doing it for themselves. And to me, in this really complicated world, is if someone does something because it makes them feel good, but it has a generally, you know, good effect,
yeah.
then that's okay, too.
My guest today is Mark Beckoff. We're talking about his new book, Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence. I believe it's a must read for all of you who would like to learn more how to see this world transformed in far better place than what it is now. And Mark, again, in your book, you talk about overpopulation and overconsumption, and you have a quote in here from Paul and Ann Ehrlich, and they say, environmental problems have contributed to numerous collapses of civilizations in the past, and now, for the first time, a global collapse appears likely. Overpopulation, overconsumption by the rich and poor choices of technologies are major drivers. Dramatic cultural change provides the main hope of averting calamity. Humankind finds itself engaged in what Prince Charles described as an act of suicide on a grand scale. Pretty bold quote.
Yep. Well, you know, basically, you know, once again, there's words that are being thrown around a lot with sometimes, you know, difficult to understand. But the word sustainable, mm-hmm. you know, is a word, you know, I call it one of the S words. You know, are we living sustainably? As human beings, we're not. We're making too many of ourselves, and we're over-consuming, and we're really depleting the resources on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's so many of us and we have a need for space, which is understandable, we're basically pushing non-human animals out of their homes. Sometimes it's a native home. sometimes it's a home into which they were pushed, and now we're pushing them further.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when people often say, when I, you know, when I talk to them, the main problem is overpopulation. And it is the main problem. It's also probably one of the most difficult to deal with because, number one, a lot of people don't like to talk about it. And number two, even if they talk about it, they're not doing much about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. I'm looking at, I mean, I would love for there to be more population control. But, you know, in a sense, rewilding is also just looking at what we can do given who we are. Given who we are, of course, is a big-brained, big-footed mammal who likes to make more humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't particularly like that given, but it's a reality right now. You know, we need more education on population control. We need to show very clearly that when there's more mouths to feed or more feet running around on our planet, we really do leave huge footprints.
Well, and when we have a compassionate heart, then we're much more reverent toward other species. And I know you write about this, and it really touched me to hear that, because all so often we're building our homes and we're building our suburbs out and out and out, into animals' habitat, expecting them to change. And somewhere I read where you talked about how where you live in the mountains outside of Boulder, how every time you walk downstairs, I think to your study or den, you're always aware of animals being close by and wanting to be sensitive that you're in their habitat.
Right. I actually have moved down from the mountains, but I lived up there for decades. And it wouldn't be uncommon for me to walk out of my front door. I had about maybe 30 or 40 foot walk to my office and see a red fox or see a black bear or sense a bear or a cougar. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that they were around, and I wanted to respect the fact that I did not build my house there, but someone did. And so, I'm living in their homes. We humans have intruded into, their homes and the homes of many other animals.
Yeah.
And so that was, I always used to say, that little walk in the morning was a constant rewilding experience. I didn't forget it because there were times when I was working in my office and I basically would look out and I would see a bobcat or a bear just staring into my window. I was constantly being rewilded. Moving into Boulder, down into the city, it's a city, but it's not a big city.
Yeah.
It also, struck me, I've got squirrels around. I got lots of birds around. And so I still have that animal experience. There's dogs around. And one of the things I try to explain to people is once I was in Central Park and I just stopped and was looking at some squirrels, and somebody must have asked me what I was doing. So I said, I'm looking at these squirrels playing and running around. And, some people said, they're just squirrels. But then there were some kids there. And I started talking to the kids. And, of course, the kids were really into it. And so for them, in a sense, that was a rewilding experience, that they were being exposed to animals, with whom they were quite familiar. But they never really thought of the squirrels in the way that I was trying to teach them.
Under global problems, we were talking about a few things we had mentioned about overpopulation. There's also climate change. What can you share with us about what you've learned about climate change? Because when that term comes up, or global warming, I still find it hard to believe that there are many in Congress who are still ignoring that reality. And I think all you have to do is look at the crazy weather patterns throughout the years.
Yeah. I write about that in a section called Homo Denialis, because humans are we're a really good denying mammal. We can look at something and deny that it's happening right in front of our eyes. It strikes me as incredibly odd that people can take a big picture view and not see that there's climate change. You always hear these jokes where people go, climate change, global warming. We just had the coldest day in Atlanta in, 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, spelling out the difference between weather and climate.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you asked that, because it's the same pattern of denial where people will, and very few, I must say, any longer, would look at two dogs playing or look at an elephant in grief and just say, they don't really feel joy, or animals don't really feel grief. They really don't have rich and deep emotions. So once again, the science now in the study of animal emotions and animal cognition is really showing very clearly that other animals are smart, emotional, and moral. But I don't know what it is, to be honest with you, that allows some people to just look at something and deny it as if it isn't existing.
Yeah. And when it comes to personal unwilding, I've often believed that our crazy, busy lifestyles and perhaps our overconsumption, in other words, a lack of simple living, is contributing to that. And you write in your book, you say, for instance, the distractions of daily life can make it very easy and convenient to unwild. We become, in some sense, out of balance and disconnected within ourselves. And as we rewild, we restore balance in our sense of connection. How do you get people or encourage people to slow down?
I don't know, but you're right. I think a lot of the alienation from nature, including other humans and other animals, comes from this incredibly consuming busy lifestyle. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have time to do this. I don't have time to do that. And one way I do it, and it's certainly not an idea that's novel to myself, but I've cashed it out, if you will, in terms of rewilding, is have people slow down. You know, that smell the roses, which yeah. really fits in terms of a rewilding mechanism. And, you know, slow down and really appreciate the magnificent world we live in. And I also tell them that it's unlikely that they're going to get more done by ignoring other nature. Mm-hmm. At some point, you know, that is the rewilding is also seen as rekindling our energy. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to fill up your car. You can't run your car into the ground without getting new gas and you know, basically rekindling the energy that you need to drive your car, or rekindling the energy that you need to interact in the world. It's hard to do, though. And you know, the sad thing is it's so hard to do even with young kids who just seem hell-bent that every second of every day has to be what they call productive, mm-hmm. and rewilding is productive. Mm-hmm. It's just a different sort of, you know, being, it's a different way of being productive.
It's a new paradigm.
It's a new paradigm, yeah. And I've been thinking a lot about it since I wrote the book, because, you know, books, of course, are works in progress. Mm-hmm. But I've been thinking about rewilding as a meme. And people know genes, kind of, you know, the way that genetics passes on different traits to future generations. Mm-hmm. And there are also these items, you could call them, it could be an item or it could be a movement, called a meme, which is cultural. So it's the way in which an idea can spread culturally. And I've begun to look at rewilding as a meme, that when enough people do it, it will catch on and more people will do it. And one of the mechanisms for it will be that it makes us feel good. You know, if you want to have animals play or do something that is really important to them, yes. you have to have it have some form of positive reinforcement, be yes. pleasurable.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, just came to me not too long ago, that as a social movement and a personal transformation, it can be really contagious mm-hmm. and become a meme. I tell you, you tell someone else, or somebody sees me, or somebody sees you doing something, and they ask why, and you explain it, and that's how it spreads. So I really honestly think if we don't begin that process, we're doomed, because we're going to be so removed and alienated from the world at large, that which will result in even more destruction. I'm hoping, of course, the bottom line is that when people rewild and reconnect, we will become more respectful and less destructive of the lives of, once again, other humans as well as other animals.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Journey's Fire with Richard Brendon. Today's topic is rewilding our hearts, building pathways of compassion and coexistence, with author Mark Beckhoff. We'll have much more of this program, but first, a short break. Today is Mark Beckhoff. We're talking about his book, Rewilding Our Hearts. And you write in your book, Mark, that to rewild, we need to make compassion, empathy, and peaceful coexistence social values. You're speaking about making moral choices. What are some of those moral choices that we need to be more mindful of?
Well, one, of course, I mean, I see overpopulation as, or the decision maybe not to overpopulate, as a moral choice. I see a decision not to overconsume and, if you will, live sustainably as a moral choice. And I also see as moral choices the way in which we interact with other humans, other animals, and all of our homes. The thing about rewilding is that it's not only a move to make the life of other animals better, it's really a transformation to make the lives of all beings better. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, you know, where we all live. And so, you know, once again, it doesn't really require anything necessarily huge. I mean, if someone's got a lot of money and wants to found an organization, great. Or if they have a lot of time to do a lot of different things. But, you know, it could be a very simple move of treating your dog better, mm-hmm. working to free animals from, you know, the horrible conditions in which they're kept in a whole lot of different venues.
Yeah.
Could be going out and helping your neighbor who is ill or infirmed or just doesn't have the time to do something.
Or as simple as, and you address this in your book, just do no harm. It reminds me of a Dalai Lama quote where he pretty much said the same thing.
Right, exactly. Do no harm. And that's kind of a motivator for yet another movement that's developing globally called compassionate conservation, which focuses on the well-being of individual animals rather than the health of species or populations or ecosystems. And that's true, you know, and I'm learning. I mean, sometimes it's a hard sell for me, but I'm learning there's a real world out there and there are going to be different trade-offs. Mm-hmm. But for me, if you really start from the ground up saying, do no harm, it actually sets a mode of thinking and feeling, an agenda, which leads you into thinking about non-lethal or non-harmful, non-injurious alternatives to deal with the problems at hand.
Yeah. You know, I found that I became an environmentalist very, very early on when I was a little boy and we had about 20 acres of woods behind my house. And I spent the majority of my time in those woods, climbing the trees, hiking the trails, fishing in the pond. And I had such a love for nature that I then, as I got older, naturally wanted to protect it. And you give credence to a beautiful work that I read many years ago. It's from the late theologian Thomas Berry. It's called The Great Work. And in that book, he stressed that our relationship with nature should be one of awe and not one of use. You used a word earlier in our conversation, re-enchanted. How do we become re-enchanted with nature, even if some of our listeners are living in New York or Chicago?
Well, once again, you know, because I see rewilding as a personal transformation, we can adapt it to wherever we are. I mean, I've been lucky to live in Colorado forever, and it's kind of a no-brainer in terms of getting out. But once again, like the example I used of going to Central Park and appreciating the squirrels, walking down a street and appreciating the flora, the trees and the bushes, appreciating bodies of water. Just, you know, once again, taking the time to really enjoy and cherish our magnificent planet.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't have those opportunities, there's plenty of really good documentaries, not only about, you know, amazing animals, but also documentaries about beautiful places in the world. So, once again, you know, it's something that people have to decide what they're able to do and what will really, if you will, re-enchant them and reconnect them, but they don't have to live. You know, some people say, well, you know, I live in the city. I don't live in the middle of nowhere like you or in a woods where there's bears and cougars and foxes and coyotes. And I'm going, well, I mean, I cherish that. But turns out that a number of people, or maybe too many, who live where I do, they come to see these animals as pests, and I'm thinking, well, you could always move.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a snide way, but you can always move. But I think once again, the rewilding paradigm allows for people to live in cities. There's a group called Biophilic Cities, and biophilic basically comes from the word biophilia, which stresses that we have a real innate, inherited attraction to nature. And so building places where other animals are allowed to run would be biophilic. Having gardens on the top of an apartment where birds or insects might come. That's all, once again, that's kind of adapting the rewilding paradigm to the local conditions.
It all fits, doesn't it? Because it does require a new paradigm. To get a new paradigm, we have to have a shift in perception of the way we're thinking and viewing things. And to do that, we've got to have a more balanced life to take the time to explore those things. But by doing that, we are creating a much better world, not only for humanity, but for ourselves as well.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the key words really is balance, because I write in there about burnout. Mm-hmm. And this it's called secondary trauma, from which a lot of people suffer, not only people who work in the animal movement, but the environmental movement, and people who work with humans who really need help, hospice workers, people working with, humans who have been traumatized for one reason or another. Burnout is very common, and the secondary trauma comes from the identification with these people or other animals who are, so in need.
Yes.
And so part of rewilding is to take care of yourself. The bottom line, like I said, there's a lot of bottom lines, but you can't rewild, and I really believe you can't rewild and have that generosity and beneficence if you don't take care of yourself. And that's not an egocentric, or self-centered view. You need to take care of yourself, and you need to take the time to basically step away from your brain. You do. And I always say for myself, because I've been really lucky, I really haven't burned out over decades, is I work hard, I play hard, and I rest hard.
I love that.
Laugh at myself. I mentioned in the book that among my mother's last words to me were, be sure you play a lot. And my father always stressed that you got to be able to take yourself lightly at times and just laugh. And sometimes I'll write something and I'll go, oh my goodness, did I really write that? Or I'll propose some solution to something and then come to realize that it's maybe in the best of all possible worlds, it would be a good solution, but it isn't. And just laugh and go, did I really say that? and stuff. But I really believe that lightness,
yes,
is really important, because this is a challenging and a demanding world. You know, just look around at the number of kids who suffer from different psychological conditions, and it's not a good prognosis for the future if you're not a happy kid early on. It just really isn't.
Well, and what you're talking about, I think, is so huge, because we see some of our greatest activists today modeling that, such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. They are so involved in such deep, serious issues, but at the same time, they are known to be so playful. And I think that balance you're talking about is huge. By the way, I love what Eileen Crist had to say about you in this book. She says, Mark Beckoff is a leading voice in the effort to ignite a rewilding social movement grounded in love, compassion, and the recognition that we are inhabitants of a magnificent planet that is calling us home. Mark Beckoff is my guest today. His book is Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence. Mark, you say that rewilding is an attitude. It's also a guide for action. And through that, as a social movement, you offer 8 P's of rewilding. Can you go through some of those for our listeners, please?
Well, to be honest, I haven't memorized the list, but I know it pretty well. I mean, one is being proactive.
Yeah.
The putting out the fire paradigm is not going to work. I say in there that we've got a very tired Earth. Mm. And, you know, I'm just tired of, and I guess I'm tired of hearing people say, oh, the Earth is really resilient. It can always bounce back. No, it's not. It can't bounce back, and we can't, we're not going to regain the planet that we used to have. I don't mean that in a negative way. Mm-hmm. In things evolve. We've evolved, ecosystems and other animals evolve. But we can't just say, oh, yeah, well, we'll do this, and then the Earth will bounce back. So being proactive, being positive, being persistent, just and passionate.
Yeah.
Go after something and don't be derailed.
Well, the persistence is important because that basically says don't give up. And I think it's so easy. People can be so overwhelmed with these looming global issues that they just want to give up.
Right. Understandably. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other, you know, tied into that giving up and the persistence is the fact that, you know, I always tell people, if you're expecting a gold star on your head every day at 5 o'clock for something that you did for the world, pick another field.
Yeah.
Because you can just tell how, you know how long it can take to have changes in mind and changes in heart, you mm-hmm. know, changes in head, changes in heart. Mm-hmm. And so I always say, just put it out there. Don't get derailed.
Yeah.
Be positive. Concentrate on what works, not what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I always say before, you know, if you're an animal activist, be for the animals, not against people.
That's a great point.
It just doesn't get you anywhere.
Right.
You know, be positive. Accept the fact that we, you know, are going to be different, be powerful, realize that, like you were saying before, I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody could be against this kind of paradigm, but there will be people.
Right.
But, you know, be powerful. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting more compassion, peace, and love in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And be playful.
Mm-hmm.
And be present. I added playfulness and being present to the original eight because, I mean, once again, you know, when people see the list, they're all really intertwined. But being present is all part of being persistent and passionate.
Yeah.
You know, and don't let people tell you, oh, this can't happen.
Well, and one of the words you've used also is practical, and I thought about that because I think what keeps us from getting overwhelmed, if we could just do one thing each day, one small act every day,
yep.
And if more and more people, as you said, the masses grew, we would have that social movement unfolding.
Exactly. And when I mean, and I really mean be practical, I mean, as an academic, you know, I can go off into la-la land, as they say. But being practical doesn't mean lowering your goals.
Right.
Being practical to me means assessing a situation, mm-hmm. seeing what's really realistic to get done, and then maybe going beyond that a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Being practical also, and this is something that rewilding is all about, is taking into account individual and cultural differences.
Okay.
You know, it would be totally impractical for me to think that people living in China, where I work on moon bear rescue, or in India, or in East Africa, are going to have the same values I do, you know, as a white guy living in Boulder, Colorado.
True.
And so I need to take that into account. Would it be nice if the entire world, you know, were or behaved in a certain way? It would be, but that's not practical.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And stuff. And so once again, what's folded into the process of rewilding is, you know, once again, an individual transformation within the culture and the social milieu within which people live.
Yeah. One of the chapters, of course, that caught my eye was Rewilding the Media. And what are some thoughts that you have about that? Because you did write that the media are an extremely powerful influence, and the messages they convey make a tangible difference in the actions we take. But not all the messages are positive, are they?
Right. The way in which non-humans are referred to. So, for example, just recently, you know, there was some kind of fight somewhere, and they said, oh, these people were acting like animals.
Uh-huh.
Well, they weren't. you know, all the latest research is showing that humans and other animals are predominantly peaceful. We harm one another. Sure, non-humans harm one another. But one of the examples people will often use is, well, Jane Goodall saw, you know, warfare in chimpanzees. Well, she saw one instance of a war in the mid to late 70s, over 54 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I always stress that it's not that animals don't harm one another. It's not that human animals don't harm and sometimes kill one another.
Yeah.
When you really look at it, it's a very tiny percentage of the total population. The other is how we refer to animals, as animals are who, not that or which. The dog, who is at the playground. The wolf, who is going home or something, not the wolf, that or which.
Yeah.
Because that and which, is we use that for objects.
Well, and by using those words, it does transform the way we view things. I still remember something John Robbins had shared about the pig, because oftentimes when we call someone a pig, it's a slur.
Yeah.
And he was saying, but the pig is the most intelligent animal and most compassionate on the face of the earth. And he felt like it was a front against the pig, you know, by associating it with a human. But you're right. We do that all the time, don't we?
We do. And in fact, I talk about the animals whom we eat, the animals whom we wear. And once again, I just put it out there. So it's, you know, who's for dinner, not necessarily what's for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And just a couple of months ago, I gave a talk in Vienna, Austria, 2 years ago. I had an email from a woman and said five of the people in the audience were going, if you will, vegetarian, because they were pondering what I said about who, not what.
Mm.
And once again, part of rewilding is being nice to the people with whom you disagree,
right,
and putting the message out there. We don't need to proselytize. Nobody likes to be told what to do. But I honestly think that we need to step out of our comfort zones, and we need to, if you will, say it like it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
mm-hmm,
you know, I have no control in the end over what you or other people do.
Mm-hmm.
But if I and others can basically give people the raw ingredient, if you will, for a recipe for rewilding, then they're going to do with it what they choose to do with it.
Yeah, and how often I've seen films also, and at the end of the movie, it'll say no animals were harmed in making this film. And I found myself wondering, is that really true? Are we to believe that?
Well, yes and no. There's been some major discoveries, even, you know, as recently as this past year, that phrase, though animals were harmed, is not necessarily true. Yeah, it just isn't. But then again, now we have movies like Noah, The Rise of the Planet of the Apes,
right,
the new Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, where no animals were used. So once again, that's rewilding the media, is saying, you know, you can show animals for whom they are. They will not be any less appealing or seductive to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need to harm animals to make movies about animals.
Mm.
And now, like I said, we've got these, you know, best-selling movies that are really showing that we can use computer-generated images and not lose we don't lose a thing. And of course, we gain a lot because animals aren't being abused to be used in, in film.
Yeah. I wanted to get your take on something that's always been important to me as a father and now a grandfather, and that's children. And you write in your book that someone else who I have dearly loved his work, Richard Louv, he coined the term nature deficit disorder in his book Last Child in the Woods. You write, since then the idea has caught on in both scientific and popular media. To me, nature deficit disorder clearly includes what I call animal deficit disorder. When youngsters and adults fail to get out into nature, they not only lose contact with landscapes and nature, but also with the animals who live there. And I hadn't really thought about that before. You even mentioned in the book that recess is okay, but that even pales in terms of what we ought to be providing our children in terms of play.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so the animal deficit disorder came to me, you know, I know you write, and sometimes people don't share with the public what the process of writing is like, but I was flipping around ADD, attention deficit disorder, and then I went, oh, Animal Deficit Disorder, ADD. Of course, you know, I chuckled at myself for my great genius. but then it came to me that, sure, part of the nature deficit disorder, and animals are part of nature, is being deprived of those experiences.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I was thrilled that Richard Louv wrote the foreword for my book. I just was touched that he would even consider it.
Well, what an honor that was. And so what you're saying is we need to be raising free-ranging kids.
Yep. I always talk about the notion of, I call it wild play. And I use a quote in there from Play Wales, which is a huge society in Wales that's devoted to studying and making sure kids get a lot of play. Their slogan is better a broken bone than a broken spirit.
I love that.
And one of the things that's come from my work on animal play, which is part of, you know, thinking about how animals play and then getting non-human animals to play as part of rewilding, is that how things have just changed. I mean, I was surprised after I wrote a book on play behavior for kids, I was having school teachers and counselors contact me to say, well, what can we do to change it? And, you know, in all honesty, and I wasn't being facetious, I said, you got to let kids be the animals who they are. You know, when I went to school, I came home with scratches, and my mother didn't think of suing the school.
Mm-hmm.
I came home with torn clothes. And I mean that seriously. And when I was at this meeting on an International Society of Play in Wales 2.5 years ago, there were 500 people from 55 countries. And do you know, there were only two countries that did not sign the UN Declaration on the Rights of Children. And the two countries were Somalia and the United States.
Oh, my God.
And the United States still has not signed on to the UN Declaration for the Rights of Kids. There's something wrong there.
That makes no sense at all.
Makes no sense.
No.
I know. I was shocked because I was, you know, and I don't mean it in any pejorative way. Okay, maybe Somalia didn't sign on to it, and I could think of other countries where they may not sign on to it.
Yeah.
When they said which two countries, and they said Somalia, I thought, oh, maybe another country that's, you know, deep in war, you know, really poverty stricken.
Yeah.
Nope, United States.
How about that?
Yeah. And so once again, rewilding education, rewilding kids, is, you know, that's all part of the general process of rewilding and reconnecting and being re-enchanted with nature. And that's why Richard, you know, Loeb's work is so incredibly important, that, you know, we are deprived, when I say the royal we, of nature, and we are deprived of experiences with other animals.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I picked it up in your writings through the years, and now in the tone of your voice, I can tell you are a wild and passionate man for the things that we're talking about, and I so love that about you. We need more people like you. Thank you for sharing your voice in the world and shining your light. Thank you for this book, Rewilding in Our Hearts. And before we go, can you share your web address with us, Mark?
Yeah, it would simply be markbeckoff.com. It would be markbeckoff.com. And that's basically my homepage.
Wonderful. It's been a joy and an honor having you on today's program.
Thank you very much for your interest in my work. I'm touched.
Blessings. That was such a joy to have conversation with Mark today. Again, his website is markbeckoff.com. We'll have much more of Journey's Fire, but first, here's another short break.
Thank you.
would take to open up our hearts. And I was reminded of a book by Dr. Gerald May called The Awakened Heart. And here are some thoughts that I had. There's a desire within each of us in the deep center of ourselves that we call our heart. We're born with it. It's never completely satisfied. It never dies. We're often unaware of it, but it's always awake. It's the human desire for love. And every person in this earth yearns to love, to be loved, to know love. Our true identity, our reason for being, is to be found in this desire. Love is the why of life, why we're functioning at all. I'm convinced it's the fundamental energy of the human spirit, the fuel on which we run, the wellspring of our vitality. And grace, which is the flowing creative activity of love, is what makes all goodness possible. Love should come first. It should be the beginning of and the reason for everything. In this book, Dr. May goes on to say, when the desire is too much to bear, we often bury it beneath frenzied thoughts and activities or escape it by dulling our immediate consciousness of living. It's possible to run away from the desire for years, even decades at a time, but we cannot eradicate it entirely. It keeps touching us in little glimpses and hints in our dreams, our hopes, our unguarded moments. You see, awakening our heart and trusting our heart wisdom allows us to understand ourselves better. The heart speaks a different language, one the intellectual mind does not understand. But if we desire to, we can learn this language and receive the wisdom and joy that an awakened heart will bring. You see, when you awaken the heart, the boundaries between self and others diminish. Each of us is linked to each other in more ways than we can imagine. We're all brothers and sisters. We are all part of the human tribe, and through service, love, and appreciation of one another, we awaken this realization. Jesus said, "For I was hungry, and you fed me, thirsty, and you gave me drink, sick, and you ministered to me, in prison, and you visited me." And they said amongst themselves, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink, sick and minister to you, in prison and visit you?" And he answered, "To the extent that you've done it unto the least of my brethren, you've done it unto me." So we're talking about the waitress who's serving you, the homeless man on the street, the annoying old woman talking too loudly. They're all God. Or you could even say they're all the face of Buddha. Our heart starts to awaken to a new reverence for life. And Carl Jung once said, it's what you are that heals, not what you do. You see, an awakened heart is a necessary condition for being able to receive the light. So consider choosing 3 days where you pay special attention to any living creature, whether it be your partner, parent, child, friend, animal companion, or even a plant. And imagine that these 3 days are the last 3 days you'll be with them. And watch how the practice of love's actions helps deepen your preparation to encounter the light and enrich your life. The value of practicing the love that opens your heart is illustrated by the story of a solitary dog who spent the last 3 days of his life being awakened by the generosity of a lonely man. One day while walking through a park, an old crippled dog came up to an old man who'd never experienced love in his entire life. And the dog caught his attention by speaking these words, "I'm old and crippled. Children don't like to look at me because I look so sick and pitiful. I only have 3 days left to live. And more than anything else in the world, I long to have the experience of being loved by my master. I want this so much that I've learned how to speak so someone could hear my request. I've searched the world for a person who would understand my situation, and I think you understand what it's like not to have love in your life. Would you please grant me my wish that you be a good master to me in my last 3 days? You don't have to really love me. It would be fine for you to pretend that you love me." The old man was moved by the sincerity of the dog's request, and without deliberation, he told that dog that he would give him the best 3 days of his life. And off they went on a great 3-day adventure. And the old man took him to a restaurant and fed him a delicious steak, showed him all the beautiful places in the park, and took him to the spots that had unique odors and smells. And the old creature was permitted to sleep on his master's bed, and throughout the night, the man rubbed the dog's belly and sang him soothing songs. And at the end of the 3 days, the dog said to the old man, "You have truly cared for me, and I am most grateful. You have enabled me to open my heart. For the first time, I know what it feels like to love someone." And the old man began weeping and replied, "I, too, have learned to love and have never felt more alive." And at that moment, a shaft of bright white light entered the old man's apartment window and transformed itself into a staircase to the sky. A voice from above was heard by all the neighbors, "Come, both of you, unto my house. You have prepared the ground for your hearts to enter the kingdom of light." And the old man with the dog by his side walked all the way up that staircase of light and disappeared into the clouds. It's said that all dogs know this story, and to this day they look to the sky when they howl their song. They haven't forgotten that it requires a heart filled with longing and love to enter the light of the heavens. And St. Francis said, "It's time to love instead of looking to be loved." You know, if we love, we'll be more loved than we ever imagined. Nothing is more beautiful than an awakened heart. And that's today's program. You know, in reflecting over the 17 years, I have to say I've enjoyed every second of it, because my sanctuaries as a deeply spiritual person have always been nature and the radio studio. I want to thank Thomas Gismondi for engineering this program. I also want to thank program coordinator and, more than that, dear friend Angel Richardson for helping, over the last few years of posting these shows and taking care of all of that. A reminder, my website is richardbrendan.com. All shows are podcast on the site, courtesy of iTunes. And for those of you who've been listening all through the years, thank you so much. You have no idea what that means to me. Occasionally I'll get emails or calls, or I'll meet someone in the store and they'll bring up that they've loved the show. And with radio, you never know who's listening. So I really appreciate that. Next week, we'll have an all-new interview. Thank you for listening, and have an amazing week.